The country of the pointed firs. I. The return. There was something about the coast town of Dunnet which made it seem more attractive than other maritime villages of eastern Maine. Perhaps it was the simple fact of acquaintance with that neighborhood which made it so attaching, and gave such interest to the rocky shore and dark woods, and the few houses which seemed to be securely wedged and tree-nailed in among the ledges by the landing. These houses made the most of their seaward view, and there was a gaiety and determined floweriness in their bits of garden ground. The small paint-high windows in the peaks of their steep gables were like knowing eyes that watched the harbor and the far sea line beyond, or looked northward all along the shore and its background of spruces and balsam firs. When one really knows a village like this and its surroundings, it is like becoming acquainted with a single person. The process of falling in love at first sight is as final as it is swift in such a case, but the growth of true friendship may be a lifelong affair. After a first brief visit made two or three summers before in the course of a yachting cruise, a lover of Dunnet Landing returned to find the unchanged shores of the pointed firs, the same quaintness of the village with its elaborate conventionalities, all that mixture of remoteness, and childish certainty of being the center of civilization of which her affectionate dreams had told. One evening in June, a single passenger landed upon the steamboat wharf. The tide was high, there was a fine crowd of spectators, and the younger portion of the company followed her with subdued excitement up the narrow street of the salt-aired, white-clapboarded little town, too. Mrs. Todd. Later, there was only one fault to find with this choice of a summer lodging place, and that was its complete lack of seclusion. At first the tiny house of Mrs. Almira Todd, which stood with its end to the street, appeared to be retired and sheltered enough from the busy world. Behind its bushy bit of a green garden, in which all the blooming things, two or three gay hollyhocks and some London pride, were pushed back against the grey shingled wall. It was a queer little garden and puzzling to a stranger, the few flowers being put at a disadvantage by so much greenery, but the discovery was soon made that Mrs. Todd was an ardent lover of herbs, both wild and tame, and the sea breezes blew into the low-end window of the house laden with not only sweetbriar and sweet mary, but balm and sage and borage and mint, wormwood and southernwood. If Mrs. Todd had occasion to step into the far corner of her herb plot, she trod heavily upon thyme, and made its fragrant presence known with all the rest. Being a very large person, her full skirts brushed and bent almost every slender stalk that her feet missed. You could always tell when she was stepping about there, even when you were half awake in the morning, and learned to know, in the course of a few weeks' experience, in exactly which corner of the garden she might be. At one side of this herb plot were other growths of a rustic pharmacopoeia, great treasures and rarities among the commoner herbs. There were some strange and pungent odors that roused a dim sense and remembrance of something in the forgotten past. Some of these might once have belonged to sacred and mystic rites, and have had some occult knowledge handed with them down the centuries, but now they pertained only to humble compounds brewed at intervals with molasses or vinegar or spirits in a small cauldron on Mrs. Todd's kitchen stove. They were dispensed to suffering neighbors, who usually came at night as if by stealth, bringing their own ancient-looking vials to be filled. One nostrum was called the Indian Remedy, and its price was but 15 cents. The whisper directions could be heard as customers passed the windows. With most remedies the purchaser was allowed to depart unadmonished from the kitchen, Mrs. Todd being a wise saver of steps, but with certain vials she gave cautions, standing in the doorway, and there were other doses which had to be accompanied on their healing way as far as the gate, while she muttered long chapters of directions, and kept up an air of secrecy and importance to the last. It may not have been only the common aids of humanity with which she tried to cope, it seemed sometimes as if love and hate and jealousy and adverse winds at sea might also find their proper remedies among the curious wild-looking plants in Mrs. Todd's garden. The village doctor and this learned herbalist were upon the best of terms. The good man may have counted upon the unfavorable effect of certain potions which he should find his opportunity in counteracting. At any rate, he now and then stopped and exchanged greetings with Mrs. Todd over the picket fence. The conversation became at once professional after the briefest preliminaries, and he would stand twirling a sweet-scented sprig in his fingers, and make suggestive jokes, perhaps about her faith in a too persistent course of thoroughward elixir, in which my landlady professed such firm belief as sometimes to endanger the life and usefulness of worthy neighbors. To arrive at this quietest of seaside villages late in June, when the busy herb-gathering season was just beginning, was also to arrive in the early prime of Mrs. Todd's activity in the brewing of old-fashioned spruce beer. This cooling and refreshing drink had been brought to wonderful perfection through a long series of experiments, it had won immense local fame, and the supplies for its manufacture were always giving out and having to be replenished. For various reasons, the seclusion and uninterrupted days which had been looked forward to proved to be very rare in this otherwise delightful corner of the world. My hostess and I had made our shrewd business agreement on the basis of a simple cold luncheon at noon, and liberal restitution in the matter of hot suppers, to provide for which the lodger might sometimes be seen hurrying down the road, late in the day, with cunter line in hand. It was soon found that this arrangement made large allowance for Mrs. Todd's slow herb gathering progresses through woods and pastures. The spruce beer customers were pretty steady in hot weather, and there were many demands for different soothing syrups and elixirs with which the unwise curiosity of my early residence had made me acquainted. Knowing Mrs. Todd to be a widow, who had little beside this slender business and the income from one hungry lodger to maintain her, one's energies and even interest were quickly bestowed, until it became a matter of course that she should go afield every pleasant day, and that the lodger should answer all peremptory knocks at the side door. In taking an occasional wisdom-giving stroll in Mrs. Todd's company, and in acting as business partner during her frequent absences, I found the July days fly fast, and it was not until I felt myself confronted with too great pride and pleasure in the display, one night, of $2.27 which I had taken in during the day, that I remembered a long piece of writing, sadly belated now, which I was bound to do. To have been patted kindly on the shoulder and called darling, to have been offered a surprise of early mushrooms for supper, to have had all the glory of making $2.27 in a single day, and then to renounce it all and withdraw from these pleasant successes, needed much resolution. Literary employments are so vexed with uncertainties at best, and it was not until the voice of conscience sounded louder in my ears than the sea on the nearest pebble beach that I said unkind words of withdrawal to Mrs. Todd. She only became more wistfully affectionate than ever in her expressions, and looked as disappointed as I expected when I frankly told her that I could no longer enjoy the pleasure of what we called seeing folks. I felt that I was cruel to a whole neighborhood in curtailing her liberty in this most important season for harvesting the different wild herbs that were so much counted upon to ease their winter ails. "Well, dear," she said sorrowfully, "I've took great advantage of your being here. I ain't had such a season for years, but I have never had nobody I could so trust. All you lack is a few qualities, but with time you'd gain judgment and experience, and be very able in the business. I'd stand right here and say it to anybody." Mrs. Todd and I were not separated or estranged by the change in our business relations. On the contrary, a deeper intimacy seemed to begin. I do not know what herb of the night it was that used sometimes to send out a penetrating odor late in the evening, after the dew had fallen, and the moon was high, and the cool air came up from the sea. Then Mrs. Todd would feel that she must talk to somebody, and I was only too glad to listen. We both fell under the spell, and she either stood outside the window, or made an errand to my sitting room, and told, it might be very commonplace news of the day, or, as happened one misty summer night, all that lay deepest in her heart. It was in this way that I came to know that she had loved one who was far above her. "No, dear, him I speak of could never think of me," she said. "When we was young together his mother didn't favor the match, and done everything she could to part us, and folks thought we both married well, but wanty what either one of us wanted most, and now we're left alone again, and might have had each other all the time. He was above being a seafaring man, and prospered more than most, he come of a high family, and my lot was plain and hard working. I ain't seen him for some years, he's forgot our youthful feelings, I expect, but a woman's heart is different, them feelings comes back when you think you've done with him, as sure as spring comes with the year. And I've always had ways of hearing about him." She stood in the center of a braided rug, and its rings of black and gray seemed to circle about her feet in the dim light. Her height and massiveness in the low room gave her the look of a huge sibyl, while the strange fragrance of the mysterious herb blew in from the little garden. 3. The schoolhouse. For some days after this, Mrs. Todd's customers came and went past my windows, and, haying time being nearly over, strangers began to arrive from the inland country, such was her widespread reputation. Sometimes I saw a pale young creature like a white windflower left over into midsummer, upon whose face consumption had set its bright and wistful mark, but oftener two stout, hard-worked women from the farms came together, and detailed their symptoms to Mrs. Todd in loud and cheerful voices, combining the satisfactions of a friendly gossip with the medical opportunity. They seemed to give much from their own store of therapeutic learning. I became aware of the school in which my landlady had strengthened her natural gift, but hers was always the governing mind, and the final command, "Take of hyssop one handful," or whatever herb it was received in respectful silence. One afternoon, when I had listened, it was impossible not to listen, with cottonless ears, and then laughed and listened again, with an idle pen in my hand, during a particularly spirited and personal conversation, I reached for my hat, and, taking blotting book and all under my arm, I resolutely fled further temptation, and walked out past the fragrant green garden and up the dusty road. The way went straight uphill, and presently I stopped and turned to look back. The tide was in, the wide harbor was surrounded by its dark woods, and the small wooden houses stood as near as they could get to the landing. Mrs. Todd's was the last house on the way inland. The gray ledges of the rocky shore were well covered with sod in most places, and the pasture bayberry and wild roses grew thick among them. I could see the higher inland country and the scattered farms. On the brink of the hill stood a little white schoolhouse, much wind-blown and weather-beaten, which was a landmark to seagoing folk. From its door there was a most beautiful view of sea and shore. The summer vacation now prevailed, and after finding the door unfastened, and taking a long look through one of the seaward windows, and reflecting afterward for some time in a shady place nearby among the bayberry bushes, I returned to the chief place of business in the village, and, to the amusement of two of the selectmen, brothers and autocrats of Dunnet Landing, I hired the schoolhouse for the rest of the vacation for 50 cents a week. Selfish as it may appear, the retired situation seemed to possess great advantages, and I spent many days there quite undisturbed, with the sea breeze blowing through the small, high windows and swaying the heavy outside shutters to and fro. I hung my hat and luncheon basket on an entry nail as if I were a small scholar, but I sat at the teacher's desk as if I were that great authority, with all the timid empty benches in rows before me. Now and then an idle sheep came and stood for a long time looking in at the door. At sundown I went back, feeling most businesslike, down toward the village again, and usually met the flavor, not of the herb garden, but of Mrs. Todd's hot supper, halfway up the hill. On the nights when there were evening meetings or other public exercises that demanded her presence, we had tea very early, and I was welcomed back as if from a long absence. Once or twice I feigned excuses for staying at home, while Mrs. Todd made distant excursions, and came home late, with both hands full and a heavily laden apron. This was in Pennyroyal time, and when the rare lobelia was in its prime and the Ella campaign was coming on. One day she appeared at the schoolhouse itself, partly out of amused curiosity about my industries, but she explained that there was no tansy in the neighborhood with such snap to it as some that grew about the schoolhouse lot. Being scuffed down all the spring made it grow so much the better, like some folks that had it hard in their youth, and were bound to make the most of themselves before they died. 4. At the schoolhouse window. One day I reached the schoolhouse very late, owing to attendance upon the funeral of an acquaintance and neighbor, with whose sad decline in health I had been familiar, and whose last days both the doctor and Mrs. Todd had tried in vain to ease. The services had taken place at 1 o'clock, and now, at 2:15, I stood at the schoolhouse window, looking down at the procession as it went along the lower road close to the shore. It was a walking funeral, and even at that distance I could recognize most of the mourners as they went their solemn way. Mrs. Begg had been very much respected, and there was a large company of friends following to her grave. She had been brought up on one of the neighboring farms, and each of the few times that I had seen her she professed great dissatisfaction with town life. The people lived too close together for her liking, at the landing, and she could not get used to the constant sound of the sea. She had lived to lament 3 seafaring husbands, and her house was decorated with West Indian curiosities, specimens of conch shells and fine coral which they had brought home from their voyages in lumber-laden ships. Mrs. Todd had told me all our neighbors' history. They had been girls together, and, to use her own phrase, had both seen trouble till they knew the best and worst on tea. I could see the sorrowful, large figure of Mrs. Todd as I stood at the window. She made a break in the procession by walking slowly and keeping the after part of it back. She held a handkerchief to her eyes, and I knew, with a pang of sympathy, that hers was not affected grief. Beside her, after much difficulty, I recognized the one strange and unrelated person in all the company, an old man who had always been mysterious to me. I could see his thin, bending figure. He wore a narrow, long-tailed coat and walked with a stick, and had the same cant to leeward as the wind-bent trees on the height above. This was Captain Littlepage, whom I had seen only once or twice before, sitting pale and old behind a closed window, never out of doors until now. Mrs. Todd always shook her head gravely when I asked a question, and said that he wasn't what he had been once, and seemed to class him with her other secrets. He might have belonged with a simple which grew in a certain slug-haunted corner of the garden, whose use she could never be betrayed into telling me, though I saw her cutting the tops by moonlight once, as if it were a charm, and not a medicine, like the great fading bloodroot leaves. I could see that she was trying to keep pace with the old captain's lighter steps. He looked like an aged grasshopper of some strange human variety. Behind this pair was a short, impatient, little person, who kept the captain's house, and gave it what Mrs. Todd and others believed to be no proper sort of care. She was usually called that Mari Harrison subdued conversation between intimates, But they treated her with anxious civility when they met her face to face. The bay sheltered islands and the great sea beyond stretched away to the far horizon southward and eastward. The little procession in the foreground looked futile and helpless on the edge of the rocky shore. It was a glorious day early in July, with a clear, high sky. There were no clouds, there was no noise of the sea. The song sparrows sang and sang, as if with joyous knowledge of immortality, and contempt for those who could so pettily concern themselves with death. I stood watching until the funeral procession had crept round a shoulder of the slope below and disappeared from the great landscape as if it had gone into a cave. An hour later I was busy at my work. Now and then a bee blundered in and took me for an enemy, but there was a useful stick upon the teacher's desk, and I rapped to call the bees to order as if they were unruly scholars, or waved them away from their riots over the ink, which I had bought at the landing store, and discovered to be scented with bergamot, as if to refresh the labors of anxious scribes. One anxious scribe felt very dull that day. A sheep bell tinkled nearby, and called her wandering wits after it. The sentences failed to catch these lovely summer cadences. For the first time I began to wish for a companion and for news from the outer world, which had been, half unconsciously, forgotten. Watching the funeral gave one a sort of pain. I began to wonder if I ought not to have walked with the rest, instead of hurrying away at the end of the services. Perhaps the Sunday gown I had put on for the occasion was making this disastrous change of feeling, but I had now made myself and my friends remember that I did not really belong to Dunnet Landing. I sighed, and turned to the half-written page again, V. Captain Littlepage. It was a long time after this. An hour was very long in that coast town where nothing stole away the shortest minute. I had lost myself completely in work, when I heard footsteps outside. There was a steep footpath between the upper and the lower road, which I climbed to shorten the way, as the children had taught me, but I believe that Mrs. Todd would find it inaccessible, unless she had occasion to seek me in great haste. I rode on, feeling like a besieged miser of time, while the footsteps came nearer, and the sheep bell tinkled away in haste as if someone had shaken a stick in its wearer's face. Then I looked, and saw Captain Littlepage passing the nearest window. The next moment he tapped politely at the door. "Come in, sir," I said, rising to meet him, and he entered, bowing with much courtesy. I stepped down from the desk and offered him a chair by the window, where he seated himself at once, being sadly spent by his climb. I returned to my fixed seat behind the teacher's desk, which gave him the lower place of a scholar. "You ought to have the place of honor, Captain Littlepage," I said. "A happy, rural seat of various views," he quoted, as he gazed out into the sunshine and up the long-winded shore. Then he glanced at me, and looked all about him as pleased as a child. My quotation was from Paradise Lost, the greatest of poems, I suppose you know? And I nodded. There's nothing that ranks, to my mind, with Paradise Lost. It's all lofty, he continued. Shakespeare was a great poet, he copied life, but you have to put up with a great deal of low talk. I now remembered that Mrs. Todd had told me one day that Captain Littlepage had overset his mind with too much reading. She had also made dark reference to his having spells of some unexplainable nature. I could not help wondering what errand had brought him out in search of me. There was something quite charming in his appearance. It was a face thin and delicate with refinement, but worn into appealing lines, as if he had suffered from loneliness and misapprehension. He looked, with his careful precision of dress, as if he were the object of cherishing care on the part of elderly unmarried sisters, but I knew Mari Harris to be a very commonplace, inelegant person, who would have no such standards. It was plain that the captain was his own attentive valet. He sat looking at me expectantly. I could not help thinking that, with his queer head and length of thinness, he was made to hop along the road of life rather than to walk. The captain was very grave indeed, and I bade my inward spirit keep close to discretion. "Poor Mrs. Begg has gone," I ventured to say. I still wore my Sunday gown by way of showing respect. "She has gone," said the captain, very easy at the last, I was informed. "She slipped away as if she were glad of the opportunity." I thought of the Countess of Carberry, and felt that history repeated itself. "She was one of the old stock," continued Captain Littlepage, with touching sincerity. "She was very much looked up to in this town, and will be missed." I wondered, as I looked at him, if he had sprung from a line of ministers. He had the refinement of look and air of command which are the heritage of the old ecclesiastical families of New England. But as Darwin says in his autobiography, there is no such king as a sea captain. He is greater even than a king or a schoolmaster. Captain Littlepage moved his chair out of the wake of the sunshine, and still sat looking at me. I began to be very eager to know upon what errand he had come. "It may be found out some of these days," he said earnestly. We may know it all, the next step, where Mrs. Begg is now, for instance. Certainty, not conjecture, is what we all desire. I suppose we shall know it all someday, said I. We shall know it while yet below, insisted the captain, with a flush of impatience on his thin cheeks. We have not looked for truth in the right direction. I know what I speak of, those who have laughed at me little know how much reason my ideas are based upon. He waved his hand toward the village below. In that handful of houses they fancy that they comprehend the universe. I smiled, and waited for him to go on. I am an old man, as you can see, he continued, and I have been a shipmaster the greater part of my life, 43 years in all. You may not think it, but I am above 80 years of age. He did not look so old, and I hastened to say so. You must have left the sea a good many years ago, then, Captain Littlepage? I said. I should have been serviceable at least 5 or 6 years more, he answered. My acquaintance with certain my experience upon a certain occasion, I might say, gave rise to prejudice. I do not mind telling you that I chanced to learn of one of the greatest discoveries that man has ever made. Now we were approaching dangerous ground, but a sudden sense of his sufferings at the hands of the ignorant came to my help, and I asked to hear more with all the deference I really felt. A swallow flew into the schoolhouse at this moment as if a kingbird were after it, and beat itself against the walls for a minute, and escaped again to the open air, but Captain Littlepage took no notice whatever of the flurry. I had a valuable cargo of general merchandise from the London docks to Fort Churchill, a station of the old company on Hudson's Bay, said the captain earnestly. We were delayed in lading, and baffled by headwinds and a heavy tumbling sea all the way north about and across. Then the fog kept us off the coast, and when I made port at last, it was too late to delay in those northern waters with such a vessel and such a crew as I had. They cared for nothing, and addled me into a fit of sickness, but my first mate was a good, excellent man, with no more idea of being frozen in there until spring than I had, so we made what speed we could to get clear of Hudson's Bay and off the coast. I owned 1/8 of the vessel, and he owned 1/16 of her. She was a full-rigged ship, called the Minerva, but she was getting old and leaky. I meant it should be my last V'Y'G.E. in her, and so it proved. She had been an excellent vessel in her day. Of the cowards aboard her I can't say so much. Then you were wrecked? I asked, as he made a long pause. I wa'n't caught astern at a lighter by any fault of mine, said the captain gloomily. We left Fort Churchill and run out into the bay with a light pair of heels, but I had been vexed to death with their red tape rigging at the company's office, and chilled with staying on deck and trying to hurry up things, and when we were well out of sight of land, heading for Hudson's Straits, I had a bad turn of some sort of fever, and had to stay below. The days were getting short, and we made good runs, all well on board but me, and the crew done their work by dint of hard driving. I began to find this unexpected narrative a little dull. Captain Littlepage spoke with a kind of slow correctness that lacked the longshore high flavor to which I had grown used, but I listened respectfully while he explained the winds having become contrary, and talked on in a dreary sort of way about his voyage, the bad weather, and the disadvantages he was under in the lightness of his ship, which bounced about like a chip in a bucket, and would not answer the rudder or properly respond to the most careful setting of sails. So there we were blowing along anyways, he complained, but looking at me at this moment, and seeing that my thoughts were unkindly wandering, he ceased to speak. It was a hard life at sea in those days, I am sure, said I, with redoubled interest. It was a dog's life, said the poor old gentleman, quite reassured, but it made men of those who followed it. I see a change for the worse even in our own town here, full of loafers now, small and poor as 'tis, who once would have followed the sea, every lazy soul of 'em. There is no occupation so fit for just that class of men who never get beyond the forecastle. I view it, in addition, that a community narrows down and grows dreadful ignorant when it is shut up to its own affairs, and gets no knowledge of the outside world except from a cheap, unprincipled newspaper. In the old days, a good part of the best men here knew 100 ports and something of the way folks lived in them. They saw the world for themselves, and likes not their wives and children saw it with them. They may not have had the best of knowledge to carry with them sightseeing, but they were some acquainted with foreign the lands and their laws, and could see outside the battle for town clerk here and done it, they got some sense of proportion. Yes, they lived more dignified, and their houses were better within and without. Shipping's a terrible loss to this part of New England from a social point of view, ma'am. I have thought of that myself, I returned, with my interest quite awakened. It accounts for the change in a great many things, the sad disappearance of sea captains, doesn't it? A shipmaster was apt to get the habit of reading, said my companion, brightening still more, and taking on a most touching air of unreserve. A captain is not expected to be familiar with his crew, and for company's sake in dull days and nights he turns to his book. Most of us old shipmasters came to know most everything about something, one would take to reading on farming topics, and some were great on medicine. But Lord help their poor crews! Or some were all for history, and now and then there'd be one like me that gave his time to the poets. I was well acquainted with a shipmaster that was all for bees and beekeeping, and if you met him in port and went aboard, he'd sit and talk a terrible while about their having so much information, and the money that could be made out of keeping him. He was one of the smartest captains that ever sailed the seas, but they used to call the Newcastle, a great barrack he commanded for many years, Tuttle's Beehive. There was old Cap'n Jameson, he had notions of Solomon's Temple, and made a very handsome little model of the same, right from the scripture measurements, same's other sailors make little ships and design new tricks of rigging and all that. No, there's nothing to take the place of shipping in a place like ours. These bicycles offend me dreadfully, they don't afford no real opportunities of experience such as a man gained on a voyage. Number when folks left home in the old days they left it to some purpose, and when they got home they stayed there and had some pride in it. There's no large-minded way of thinking now, the worst have got to be best and rule everything, we're all turned upside down and going back year by year. Oh no, Captain Littlepage, I hope not, said I, trying to soothe his feelings. There was a silence in the schoolhouse, but we could hear the noise of the water on a beach below. It sounded like the strange warning wave that gives notice of the turn of the tide. A late golden robin, with the most joyful and eager of voices, was singing close by in a thicket of wild roses. Fie! The waiting place. How did you manage with the rest of that rough voyage on the Minerva? I asked. I shall be glad to explain to you, said Captain Littlepage, forgetting his grievances for the moment. If I had a map at hand I could explain better. We were driven to and fro way up toward what we used to call Perry's Discoveries, and lost our bearings. It was thick and foggy, and at last I lost my ship, she drove on a rock, and we managed to get ashore on what I took to be a barren island, the few of us that were left alive. When she first struck, the sea was somewhat calmer than it had been, and most of the crew, against orders, manned the longboat and put off in a hurry, and were never heard of more. Our own boat upset, but the carpenter kept himself and me above water, and we drifted in. I had no strength to call upon after my recent fever, and laid down to die, but he found the tracks of a man and dog the second day, and got along the shore to one of those far missionary stations that the Moravians support. They were very poor themselves, and in distress, 'twas a useless place. There were but few Eskimo left in that region. There we remained for some time, and I became acquainted with strange events. The captain lifted his head and gave me a questioning glance. I could not help noticing that the dulled look in his eyes had gone, and there was instead a clear intentness that made them seem dark and piercing. There was a supply ship expected, and the pastor, an excellent Christian man, made no doubt that we should get passage in her. He was hoping that orders would come to break up the station, but everything was uncertain, and we got on the best we could for a while. We fished, and helped the people in other ways, there was no other way of paying our debts. I was taken to the pastor's house until I got better, but they were crowded, and I felt myself in the way, and made excuse to join with an old seaman, a Scotchman, who had built him a warm cabin, and had room in it for another. He was looked upon with regard, and had stood by the pastor in some troubles with the people. He had been on one of those English exploring parties that found one end of the road to the North Pole, but never could find the other. We lived like dogs in a kennel, or so you thought if you had seen the hut from the outside, but the main thing was to keep warm. There were piles of bird skins to lie on, and he'd made him a good bunk, and there was another for me. 'Twas dreadful dreary wait in there, we begun to think the supply steamer was lost, and my poor ship broke up and strewed herself all along the shore. We got to watching on the headlands, my men and me knew the people were short of supplies and had to pinch themselves. It ought to read in the Bible, man cannot live by fish alone, if they'd told the truth of things, 'tain't bread that wears the worst on you. First part of the time, old Gaffett, that I lived with, seemed speechless, and I didn't know what to make of him, nor he of me, I dare say, but as we got acquainted, I found he'd been through more disasters than I had, and had troubles that wa'n't he going to let him live a great while. It used to ease his mind to talk to an understanding person, so we used to sit and talk together all day, if it rained or blew so that we couldn't get out. I'd got a bad blow on the back of my head at the time we came ashore, and it pained me at times, and my strength was broken. Anyway, I've never been so able since. Captain Littlepage fell into a reverie. Then I had the good of my reading, he explained presently. I had no books, The pastor spoke but little English, and all his books were foreign, but I used to say over all I could remember. The old poets little knew what comfort they could be to a man.